Hello everyone, I'm Patrick Casey and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. Red Ice is an independent media outlet, which offers perspectives on a number of issues you won't find in the mainstream. This show is normally hosted by Henrik Palmgren, who is currently busy moving across the country. Today's guest is Ryan Dawson. Ryan is the founder of the Anti-Neocon Report, a website that features podcasts on politics and economics with professionals from around the world. He's also written a few books and created a number of films, all of which are available on his website. Welcome to Red Ice, Ryan. How are you?
I'm good. I've heard of your show for a long time, so I was glad to be invited. Excited about that.
Great. Well, before we dive into things, why don't we start off with you telling the audience a little bit about yourself?
What do you want to know? I run the ANC Report, which is short for Anti-Neocons Report, and I've been doing that for many years. Prior to that, I had a forum by the same name. Prior to that, I had a MySpace by the same name. Prior to that, I had AOL Hometown. So, as things improved, so did I.
So other than being opposed to neoconservatism, what other things do you touch on at the Anti-Neocon Report?
Well, it's definitely an anti-war site as well. If there ever was a just war, I would say so, but there isn't. There hasn't been in recent times. So it's an anti-war site. It's an anti-neocon site. It's very heavily anti-Zionist. Because Zionism, for the first two things, they're almost, I don't think there is a neocon who's not also Zionist. And, of course, they're a good formula for killing your neighbors and starting conflicts. So, we touch on economic issues as well. I don't think you can really separate warfare from the economy anyway. I remember when people used to say, I like Ron Paul on foreign policy, but I don't like him domestically or on the economy. I'm like, what are you talking about? There's a $6 trillion expenditure. You can't just neatly separate that from econ. But so we get into all that, and I have guests on my show. I have a lot of black sheep on my podcast, whether it's Tom Goodrich or David Cole, Gilad Osman, like people that are other people are afraid to talk to. Not you guys, probably, but a lot of people.
Yeah, we've had some of them on the show in the past, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Veronica Clark, I think she, after my show, was on your show. So, you know, I just like getting people with nuanced positions, and I'll judge for myself. I don't care what's written about them online because there's a lot of bull about myself. If you Google my name, you know, there are people trashing me, and it's all BS. But, yeah, so I've had a large range of different type of guests on different political topics. Mainly recently it's been the Middle East, of course, the North and South Korea, which I live next to, and, you know, American politics. Those are the three spheres. And then now and then I'll get into African, Ukraine, I mean, you name it, wherever there's a conflict, terrorism, or a war, I'll have an opinion about it, and I'll be telling people.
So the main subject of our show is the recent reconciliation between North and South Korea. Why don't you explain to us what went down?
I'd love to. So I've been doing RT and Press TV reports all year and all last year following this, and a lot of people, it seems like they just watched the most recent talk between President Moon and Kim Jong-un, and they start the story from there. And then, of course, they're all confused because if you start the story from there, it's impossible to know what's going on. And they're giving Trump a lot of credit that he doesn't deserve, although I don't mind him taking it because the alternative is worse. But if you just want to, from a truthful perspective, if you want to honor anybody for making this deal, it's President Moon, which is why he was elected. So if you rewind back, prior to President Moon was President Park, and she was awful, and she's in jail right now. South Koreans, unlike a lot of places, especially Japan, for example, Japanese people are apolitical, just completely apathetic because things seem to be working fine, so why get concerned, right? Why even bother?
Right.
But in South Korea, the public, the general public is very political, because of North Korea. Like, it makes you care. Whereas in other states, with not much going on, you know, until something's happening, oh, there's refugees pouring in, or there's some reason to get political. Well, they got a reason. They got guns pointed at them every day. So the apathy is very small. So this is what allowed them, when their president got busted in a lot of shenanigans, they impeached her, and they put her in jail. And the new person they elected after her is President Moon Jae-in, who's in now. And they elected him on the platform of Sunshine Policy. And the Sunshine Policy is actually, you could call it Sunshine Policy 2. because there was a sunshine policy in the past, which was working, and it got derailed. And I can explain that later. And it's named after one of Aesop's fables. And maybe you've heard the story of the sun and the wind. You ever heard that story?
I don't think I have, no.
All right, well, I like it. It's a nice little kid's story, but it's good for grown-ups as well. The point is, there's a man walking with a coat and a hat, and the sun and the wind are talking, and they have a little bet, and the wind says, I bet I can get that man to take off his coat. And he blows, and he knocks the hat off, and the man goes back and gets it, and he holds it to his head, and the harder the wind blows, the harder the man clings to his coat. And the wind blows and blows, and the guy just holds on more. He falls backwards, but he doesn't let go of his coat because he needs his coat. It's windy. And the sun says, let me have a try. And he just heats up a little bit, and the guy takes his hat and coat off himself, right? And so the point is, sometimes the more you threaten somebody, you know, you're going to get the opposite result, which is what they're saying with Korea. We've tried 50 years of sanctions and threats and war games, and all they do is continue to build up their military just the same, right? So why don't we try an olive branch instead, a carrot instead of a stick? And so they named it Sunshine Policy. And in the Korean language, it comes out all cool as well. So Sunshine Policy 2 was to say something that was the thing that had worked the best in the past was the first time they tried it before the six-party talks. The six parties are Russia, China, the United States, and then, of course, North and South Korea. And Japan. And so, and Japan, you remember, had annexed all of Korea for almost 40 years. So, there's a lot of bad taste in the older generation with the Japanese. But they also have a lot of the administration left over in North Korea came right out of that ilk. So, and they're their largest trading partner, so they have a lot of influence. So China, Japan, Russia, the two Koreas and the United States came up with this plan that Korea would, in steps, start to denuclearize. And as they did such, you know, as they did step one, there would be rewards, economic rewards, cooperation and zones and things they need because they're drowning in communism. But only not all at once, like, okay, you stop enriching uranium and then we'll do this. You stop this, we'll do that. And even the North agreed. So North Korea and South Korea and China and Russia all agreed. But the U.S. and Japan didn't. And that's because of some Japanese hostages were taken right at the time and it just ruined the entire thing. But it had been working up to that point. And so then it went the opposite direction because the U.S. started making more threats and North Korea saw what had happened in Iraq and then later what happens in Libya. And there's no way they're going to not try to get nuclear weapons. They already had a deterrent because even without nuclear weapons, just with the conventional artillery and things that they have, they would be able to kill a couple million people in South Korea if they ever got invaded. So when Trump was talking about this bloody nose policy, that was completely insane because there is no military solution in North Korea. As soon as you hit them, they'd fire and their THAAD is not going to do diddly. They would annihilate a couple million people in Seoul. And so that already ensured that there's no military solution. But North Korea still had no way out because it's like, okay, they're not going to attack us, but at the same time, they're not lifting any of these sanctions where 10% of their country is starving to death, mostly because of communism. They don't have any sanctions on agriculture. Like, we actually send them food, but that doesn't really matter. That's like a lot of African states. Sending people food doesn't fix the problem. They need the machine parts and things for farming equipment and so on to produce their own food. And they already have 30% of their population in agriculture. But it doesn't matter when you got 10 guys or 20 guys pulling a plow because you don't have an ox or a tractor. You know, they don't have enough outside the capital. So the sanctions indirectly are sanctions on agriculture, even though we don't have any directly on food stock or anything. And so that's what they need. But they don't really have anything to offer. So what they did is they used this nuclear program as a bargaining chip. We're going to get nukes, and then we're going to get rid of them, you know, as we're going to negotiate them away, because they can never use them anyway. So we'll say, all right, we'll get rid of our ICBM program, and we'll get rid of our nuclear program if you can lift some of these sanctions, travel restrictions, and so on. And it worked. Because Trump was threatening them. Everybody remembers Little Rocket Man. Except,
right.
I kind of say it's funny. But it was quite clever because when Trump did that, whether this is intentional or serendipitous or whatever, people have different opinions, but he pissed them off so much that when the North Korean foreign minister, who had a UN platform, you know, to say, you know, our grievances are foul eagle, this joint exercise the U.S. and South Korea do every year where they do mock invasions of the North. We'd like them to cut that out. They didn't talk about any of that at all. All they did was respond to the Rocket Man crap. And so he basically trolled them so hard that they lost a golden opportunity. That was a mistake on the North's part because they're both egotistical maniacs, and Kim Jong-un even more than Trump. And so they, if you can imagine, I mean, Trump put his name on buildings and anyway, so he won and everybody chastised him on that. Like, oh my gosh, this is embarrassing. The president of the United States is saying Little Rocket Man, but you know what? It worked. And then, you know, a little bit later, he was calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas. So just give up on being embarrassed or not. But, so it moves along. North Korea does get the bomb because Trump put even tighter sanctions on them. Or tried to. They just get around them through the black market. But then he starts threatening to put trade tariffs on China and South Korea. He did not want South Korea and North Korea to meet. And this is very vital for people to understand because he's getting all this credit right now. The Americans said, no, don't do that. The only American that said otherwise is probably Dennis Rodman, the basketball player. If anybody deserves a Nobel Peace Prize, it's Dennis Rodman. Because Dennis Rodman said, you know what, maybe we should do little things first, play sports together, music, you know, get some cultural ties first, and then some economic policies, and why don't we just talk to him one-on-one? And everybody raked him over the coals. That was back in 2013, I think, when he went over there. And I was sitting there thinking, I think everything Dennis said is perfectly reasonable. But like, why would you legitimize him by talking to this monster? Like, because the monster's legit control of that area, and you have to. So that's exactly what happened during the Olympics. They had a joint hockey team. It's not the first time, but they did that again. And then they had Red Velvet, which is a K-pop band, and some other K-pop bands go and play in the capital of North Korea. And Kim Jong-un actually surprised everybody, went and attended, took pictures with everybody. And so they start with sports and music, and then they had a one-on-one meeting against Trump's orders. He threatened to put steel tariffs on South Korea if they did it. But there's so much pressure from Moon's base that they did it anyway. And it was very successful. Then Trump changes and he doesn't put the tariffs on. And now he's like, yeah, that was all my idea. And then Moon gives him credit. And this is what confuses people. Like, well, why would the South Korean president say Trump deserves the Nobel Peace Prize and give him credit for this meeting that he didn't even attend and actually opposed? Well, the reason is because Trump and Kim Jong-un are going to meet this month. It may get bumped the next month, but they're going to meet soon. And what the South has done is very clever. He's played a nice hand where he has an agreement in place. The whole world has seen it. The 25-second handshake and them coming across the DMZ and all that. Everybody's seen this. And he's given Trump credit, being like, it's great that you want us to have peace.
Right.
So it's going to be very hard now for Trump to go into his meeting and screw it all up, because if he does, the whole world will know it's him, right? So they've praised him. Yes, you did. You were part of this, and you were so great. So now he can't backtrack. Although, sad to say, they're already starting to. They're making these impossible demands, like move all your artillery away from the line and have an irreversible, you know, all at once, no nuclear program, get rid of some of your conventional things, get all your Japanese abductees and return them alive, which they can't because some of them are dead. And so, you know, somebody's got to get in there and ghoul him off and say, look, just take the win. Like, we've got a peace agreement. Just do it, you know. And I'm hoping he will. But it's not just him. It's all the pressure around him because they didn't even want him to go. It's Kim Jong-un that reached out to him, too. He said, called, and apparently, this is what I heard, is it was near the Oval Office, they're having a meeting, and all of them are in agreement, we can't legitimize them, blah, you know, the stuff you've heard for the last 30 years. And Trump just came in through the door and said, I'll do it. And they're all shocked. What? He's like, I'll do it. I'll talk to him. So good on him. So he deserves credit for that. I just hope he doesn't screw it up. Because really, if America and China would just get out of the way, it would already be over. You know, like the North and South met each other, made an agreement. Why do they have to get permission from all these other, you know, bully states? Well, because they do, and that's real politics, but they shouldn't have to. They should be able to make an agreement on their own. They're two sovereign states. South Korea is the 11th largest economy in the world. I mean, they should be allowed to make their own deals with their neighbors, but the armistice agreement, where they never actually officially ended the war between the Koreas, has China and the U.S.'s signature on it. So legally, they now have to go talk to them. And I don't think it shouldn't be a problem. Like, there's nothing to gain by keeping them at war when North Korea has an ICBM that can reach the United States. Prior to them having that, there was a lot to gain because they could send it. There's billions and billions of dollars for China and the U.S. to use North Korea as an excuse to build up their own military industrial complexes, naval budgets, missiles, missile defenses, and so on. But it's gotten to the point where it's too dangerous to keep playing that game. Because they shot it, and they got into space, you know. So they need them to get rid of that weapon. And so they're going to have to capitulate some. And I believe they will. But it's all the right things for the wrong reasons. I don't care. I take it as a win.
Okay, so you mentioned China's involvement in all of this. Obviously, mm-hmm. there are many other geopolitical powers who have a vested interest in the Koreas. So why don't you talk a bit more about China and Japan and, you know, what they stand to gain or lose from these peace talks?
Well, Japan actually stands to gain a lot. Well, not Japan, Okinawa, at least. Because if, let's say, they're going to denuclearize 100% because they're so desperate, they can't eat, right? So they'll do something. I think Moon is going to turn around and say, hey, we're at peace now. Maybe you should reduce or even close these bases of all these American troops, because the bases in South Korea, if the shit went down, so sorry for that word, but if it hit the fan, that base can't do anything. It's what Colonel Wilkerson calls a tripwire base. We just have some Americans around in the area, so when they get killed, we can point to it and go, oh my God, they killed Americans, and that caucus ally to come in with the rest of the Navy and Army. So why even have it, you know? And it's expensive, and it causes a lot of problems. There's a lot of rape associated. That's what happens when you have a bunch of 19-year-old males living together with guns and their whatever. So if they can roll that back, then Japan can say the same. Hey, your justification the whole time to have these bases in Japan was North Korea. Now, actually, it's China. But officially, it's all the official excuse has been North Korea. Anyone that's not retarded knows it's never been North Korea. It's always been about China. When they put the THAAD, which is the thermal high altitude, I forgot the last day, but it's a missile defense system with very long range radar, because it's got long, mid, and short range defenses. And it penetrates into China and Russia. And they stick it in the middle of the country. And so it was like, why isn't it up near the border? Is that where the missiles come in? Well, no, because then the radar would go even deeper. So you can see they're just politicking about China. It's not even about defense. It was just about how much does it cost? Sounds good. There's another budgetary item. It doesn't matter how useless it is, and it looks good. So South Korea can be like, look, we got these American defense systems. And the normal person doesn't know much specifically about military hardware, so they're just like, oh, yeah, more defense. I support that, you know, because they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to have to roll all that back. Now, they've already gotten their checks, so they don't care. But if that rolls back and Japan rolls back, then Taiwan's going to roll back. And you could even see somebody like Germany saying, hey, the bases that have been in since World War II in Japan, you know, you've got bases in Germany. Why? Who around Germany is threatening the United States, you know?
Right.
So it could cascade into pulling them all home, which is something Trump ran on in his ticket. He's like, to build up the military so you never have to use it. How many places can we be? Why don't we bring them all home and protect our own border? Blah, blah, blah. That was his rhetoric. He's yet to do any of it. But he'll have a golden opportunity of which, you know, the Korea peace process could kick off the whole thing. Now, for China, basically the opposite of everything I just said. China has also used the tension between North and South for its own means, because since the Americans are building up, they also have to build up, right? And I understand that. But they've kind of kept North Korea on life support. They're walking a tightrope because they don't want North Korea to collapse because of all the refugees that were born in China, and it would be a headache. And they just don't want a total failed state that has all that armory. But they don't want them to thrive either, because it's run by a lunatic and it's communist, and, you know, that's, both options are bad. So China has tried to look the other way for black markets and allow some steel and sell oil, or allow oil to go through there. They don't actually sell it. It's Russian oil. And allow, you know, the minimal to keep North Korea sort of balanced. And so they've been doing this strange policy of just enough to keep them, you know, a little bit of a threat and alive, but not collapse, but not be able to change the power hegemony either. And so if there's finally a peace process, I think, one, they'd like to return a lot of refugees that have escaped back to North Korea. I'm sure they'd probably like to leave as well. Some of them are in Japan, too, because they get treated very badly in China and in South Korea. So that's going to be good for China as well. It's good for everyone on the business level and personal level. It's just the militaries that are going to be upset about it because they've been making so much money off of it, and they won't really have that excuse anymore.
Where does Russia stand in all of this?
So back when Russia was part of the Soviet Union, they essentially propped up North Korea completely. And after their collapse was when North Korea lost 10% of its population to starvation. And they have labor camps with 11-year-olds in there, right? And this is not propaganda. Like, I've met people who have been in the prisons. There's a Japanese friend of mine. He was in the book Why Peace by Mark Gutman. I was a co-author also of that book. There's a lot of co-authors. It was just stories from around the world from all these people. And this man, Nabuske, was helping North Koreans escape into China and then ultimately to South Korea. And he got caught. He's a Japanese man. And they threw him in a gulag. And they ate rats and all, you know, it's a horror story. And their children in there with the skin peeling off their shoulders, or they're carrying these grains of rice and getting hit with canes and whips and stuff. And they just work them. I mean, if you have the tiniest like infringement, if you get caught watching a movie from China or something, you might end up in a prison camp, and so will your family. So they, I mean, there's three classes in North Carolina, or in North Korea. I'm from North Carolina. There's three classes in North Korea. This a red and white and is it blue? It might be red, white, and blue. But anyway, the top tier that are kind of the oligarchs of that live in the capital have one life. And then you've got the middle and the lower. And the lower is just like, just eat dirt and die. And if the middle or the upper screw up, they go down a caste, right? And it's collective punishment. It happens to their whole family. So this is how he's able to maintain the control that he has of these people. Anytime it seems like there's people who have a sort of anti-Western slant just because America has all these wars, and yeah, it was stupid to go into Iraq and all the imperial escapades. Like, I have been in disagreement with them all too. And so they think when they oppose North Korea that somehow North Korea is actually the good guys because America doesn't like them. No, there's bad and there's worse. And the same thing, they'd be like, oh, China and Russia. I'm like, don't lump them together because they're not. So Russia, as the Soviet Union, had propped up North Korea and couldn't, after its collapse, it couldn't even take care of itself. I mean, lots of Russians were starving too. And they never really transitioned to capitalism because when Yegor Gaidar was prime minister of Russia and Yeltsin was a drunk and in the hospital for over a year, he essentially ran the country. And he let these Jewish oligarchs take over all the key industries of metal, like aluminum, nickel, oil, all the most valuable assets in Russia were divided up between these seven oligarchs. And they rigged bidding processes so that instead of having venture capitalists come in and bid and divide up the companies and market competition and all like you're supposed to, they essentially locked them all out and then overpraised their own assets, bid against each other, only like $1 more than the other guy, and walked away with everything for pennies on the dollar. I was like, Boris Borzovsky and Khodorkovsky did that with Sibneft, which is Gazprom, is what everyone says today. That was all transferred to these oligarchs through the nepotism of the state. So they never really got, until Putin came along, they never really had that market competition. And once you're on top and you're a billionaire, you know, that's very hard to fight. It's the worst level of crony capitalism the world's ever seen. So they basically transitioned from communism to an extreme level of crony capitalism. And, you know, basically Yeltsin had to cede power. Geiger had to get out. Putin comes in. He exiles these oligarchs, throws a couple in jail, and basically threatened them, starts his own media, starts breaking up the monopolies. So like him or not, he's been very good for Russia. And the way that he's treated North Korea is very similar. Like, look, this is a pariah state and shouldn't be supported. But at the same time, he's kind of like China. We don't want him to collapse either. Because that would be bad. It'd be bad for the people. You don't want a bunch of people starving to death. So they have always tried to get the United States and Japan to agree with what I was talking about earlier, the Sunshine Policy. So last year, well, a year and a half ago, actually, Vladimir Putin proposed something called a double freeze. And what the double freeze was North Korea will freeze its nuclear program, and by doing such, South Korea and America will agree to freeze their Foul Eagle exercise, which is the war games they do every year, where they basically play a game where they're going to invade North Korea. And they've even, in 2010, crossed the waters. Their ships actually went into North Korean territory, which was responded. North Korea fired artillery and killed a South Korean on a small island out. Started shooting at each other. So, you know, they nudging it more and more every year until this April. So a few things happen. One, totally by chance, the Winter Olympics were in South Korea. So they just had a lot to deal with, and they postponed the war game. And when they did, North Korea started to say, okay, let's play sports together. And they sent Kim Jong-un's sister, went to the games and was in South Korea, and everyone was filming like, oh, she's kind of hot, or whatever. That's all they talked about. It's just sad. But then when the war games did happen, and that was just last month, it was April, the U.S. did not include any of their nuclear submarines, any of their carriers like the Carl Vinson, any of their supersonic bombers. None of the hard hitters were there. You know, it was just like Hawkeye and Black Widow, like Hulk and Thor, they were gone. Yeah. But the Pentagon said, no, we didn't downplay it at all. We're just going onward, and we're having our Foul Eagle, and we're not listening to the North. But guys like me that look at the details, and you can look at the map and see where the carriers are and stuff, and RT and some others, they cover it and go, actually, it's not the same. They have the same troop levels, but all the hard hitters aren't here. So they did start to roll back on Foul Eagle, which was a good move. And that got the North to come to the table and meet with Moon. And now we can start with the story everybody's familiar with, where they have their handshake and they trade meals, and they made him a Swedish dish because he was, or Switzerland, he was educated over there. And Kim Jong-un speaks perfect English well, as too. So they're going to meet president to dictator, or dictator to dictator, however you want to see that. And we'll come what may. I hope Trump will not try. He's trying this New York Yankees highball tactic where he goes in with all these giant demands so that he has room to come down. But that's actually a very bad negotiation tactic. It works in the West, but it's not the way a lot of in Asian culture, the way they negotiate is a lot like Alexander the Great. They give you the best deal, and if you don't take it, the next deal is worse. So I hope he understands that going in there. I mean, it seems like somebody around him should know about that, but everyone around him is just a bunch of military guys with ribbons on their chest, and they don't really study culture very much, it seems like. They study tactics and stuff, but they don't really get that.
So Deng Xiaoping was responsible for instituting market reforms in China that helped turn it into the successful economy and country that it is today. Do you think there's any potential for Kim Jong-un to be a similar figure in Korea? North Korea.
well, something they were doing. Like, China's always had a thriving black market, so it was a little bit easier to transition. Mm-hmm. North Korea is really, I mean, it's like a, it's so outrageous, you wouldn't believe it unless you go there. Like, there are parts where there are no cars on the road. I mean, that was, China never hit that level, you know. But what they were doing that was working was this cooperative economic zones where the South would put a factory up in the North and hire North Korean workers who got, you know, wages instead of getting rations. They got wages, which they could use on whatever. Because, like, the capital city in North Korea has two supermarkets. And we can laugh, oh, two supermarkets. Not two kinds, just two. One, two, that's it. Where if you have money, you can buy things. So they are so far behind. I mean, there are parts of North Korea where people have never seen a plastic bottle. I've talked to refugees that when they finally got to China, they wanted to get out of the car because they saw these plastic bottles on the side of the road. And like, that's trash. I mean, you can get those everywhere. But to them, it was, you know, just shocking, unbelievable. They're really, really far behind. So it's going to take, they're going to have to be a lot of economists. Not, I mean, I can give my 2 cents, but it's going to take like what they were doing, taking it zone by zone and introducing capitalist concepts and wages. There's an interesting story. I don't know if you ever, you know what a moon pie is? Do you have those over there? It's like a,
yeah, we do.
Chocolate marshmallow cookie thing. It's very popular in the American South as well. There's something called choco pie here and in Korea. Because you have to remember, a lot of Japanese companies used to be in Korea too, because they own the whole thing. So I don't want to get into that thing, but they, were making these choco pies in North Korea, and the company decided to give some out as bonuses. Like, they paid them, and you know what? Here's a box of these pies for yourself and your family or whatever. It got to the point that these pies were going around in the black market in North Korea, you know, under severe penalty, for $10 a pie. I think you get a packet of them for like a dollar. But 10 in Japan, you can get for $10 a lot of money in North Korea. And that's how much a cookie was. Because it was taboo, it's from the South, it's something they never had, and it's food. So it was very valuable. When the leadership got wind of it, they shut the factory down, so no more moon pies, sent it back to South Korea, and then the South Korean activists got together, and they bought, all these people donated, and they bought thousands of moon pies, and they tied them to these giant cylinder-like hot air balloons, and when the wind was right, just sent them into North Korea, like, here, have some pie. And so this is the level of ridiculousness. It is. You can YouTube this stuff. Just write, like, chocolate pie, South Korea. They sent in balloons full of pies, and they put little propaganda pamphlets in there, too. And soldiers were shooting them down and getting the pies. And, like, I mean, that's how, just to get a dessert, you know, that's the level we're dealing with. So it could be a lot harder than China to restructure the market in North Korea. But it is all doable. I mean, free markets work naturally. Like, even in jail, you get a free market. Even if people are trading cigarettes or whatever, like, markets just arise. It's natural. You have to be forced not to do it, you know. People want to trade stuff. You know, you got something, I got something, we can mutually benefit. Let's exchange. That's all capitalism is. That's all it is without government. So,
yeah, it works for a reason, and it's prevalent for a reason. And as you said, during Maoist China, during the Great Leap Forward, during the Cultural Revolution, people were still, you know, they still had markets. They were just black markets. So it's a hard force to contain, honestly.
They can get rid of private property, like physically, I mean, not let you own land and no copyrights and stuff. And that's really going to crush you in a lot of ways. Like, your environmental standards going to go way down, because it turns out when people don't own their own land, they don't care. You know, it's just, oh, just throw it over there. And so you see the smog and pollution problems in China because just from so many years of nobody owning private property under communism, that, you know, people will take care of their own stuff. Like, if you own a river, you're not going to let anyone throw cement, you know, or in your yard, like, would you, right? It's all where somebody doesn't own something, where everything is dumped. But because, and if someone else does it, you can sue them. It's private property. You're violating private property. So you don't need all these other extra environmental laws. But that's one problem. Another problem is patency law, copyright law. It's a big problem in China. You got a billion people. Why aren't they inventing everything? I mean, look at all those brains. There's a high IQ, billion, you know, plus population, but they're not coming out with the latest cell phone or the hybrid car or any of the stuff like South Korea and Japan are. Or the United States, they're not doing that. They're not coming out with the latest gaming console or games or anything. All they can do is buy stuff because there's no innovation, because there's no profit motive. It doesn't matter how many people you have or how smart they are. If there's no profit motive, it's not going to work. And that's why I've been trying to explain to people, like, look, your policy and economic system trump everything else. Like, that predicates the rest of it. You can start adding other reasons and whatever after that, but that is the most important thing. And so, but China, even when they didn't have private property, they still had, it's so big, and it's never really been united. There's Cantonese and Mandarin, and it's Tibetan, so there's three really groups already in China. And it's such a vast territory, it's impossible to police all the black markets. And they'll just do it like right on the street, you know. It's impossible. But they did crush a lot of it. But it was they were very quick to jump back into it once they were allowed to. And now China is the second largest market on earth. They should be number one, given their population size, but they're still second behind the United States. Well, they're about even with Japan. It's kind of second or third, depends on the year, but they will surpass Japan, and they will surpass the United States if they, you know, as long as they don't go backward. They continue with capitalist practices, and if they could clean up their copyright violations and things like that, then they could sit on top. But they aren't, so they don't.
So what do you think the future holds for North Korea? Do you think it's going to begin to resemble South Korea more, or is it going to more or less stay the same?
I think, well, if you look, the only thing in recent time we can really compare it to would be like East Germany, West Germany. Although the gap between North and South Korea is a lot more wide than Germany, and they've been apart for a lot longer. But, you know, East Germany, even though they only had two cars, like two types of cars, and they suffered under the yoke of communism and the glory of the USSR, they were able to quickly assimilate because they still spoke German, and these people still, they still have the same language, you know. They were able to reintegrate and be part of the nation. So the problem is, with that case in East Germany, the leadership was always in Russia anyway. So it's like, well, they already fell. So, but in North Korea, he's the boss. So why would he give up his own power? So they may, you know, just in real politic, pragmatic terms, not idealistic terms, they're going to have to let him be like governor of Pyongyang or something. He's going to have to maintain some sort of power over a place in North Korea. Because he's just not going to just capitulate. And he's got a following, like cult-like, god-like following. And so like an emperor almost. Like, you're going to need him to tell people what you want, or they ain't going to listen. So he will maintain some sort of power for a time. And as things improve economically, the way to defeat North Korea isn't with guns or sanctions. It's with McDonald's and Mickey Mouse. And that's how it's going to go.
Definitely. I think that's kind of...
there is.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that might be a mixed bag for the... for the North Korean people in the long term, but I suppose that, you know, McDonald's is better than starvation at the end of the day.
It is, and you don't have to go. Well, it'll just be like McDonald's in Japan. McDonald's in Japan is not like the lowbrow crap in the United States. Burger King in Japan, you can get beer and Jim Beam and shrimp burgers, and it's different. You know, it's just sort of the same, but they have fries and something, but, you know, the qualities, the service and the food is all better. They've got rules against MSG. They have rules against GMO. They have rules about it. So it'll be in title only, but the level of distribution and the capital behind these giant billion-dollar companies, they don't care if they have to change the model a little bit per area because they're still getting profits. So, you know, it's better than starving. And if they build up their industry, they'll be able to maintain their own. I mean, look at South Korea with Samsung and Kia and all that. The brand names all around the world make a lot of money, uniquely Korean. It's all good, but you are going to have to share. We all benefit. You know, it's just the United States is glad to have Panasonic and Sony and Toyota and the things from Japan, but in exchange, Japan also has to accept Apple and Windows and the giant American company, Disney and so on, and they just pick the ones they like and tell the rest to piss off, and that's how markets are. But on the whole, the general standard of living will definitely rise for the North, and that's a good thing.
So what can we expect from future peace talks between the two Koreas?
Well, the next one will be either this month or next. It's supposed to be this month. But that's with Trump in North Korea. If he can get on the same page as what Moon has already laid in his lap, then I think they've already decommissioned a nuclear site in the northern part of North Korea. And there will be more to follow. And hopefully the U.S. and the South will uphold its part of the deal. They're talking about connecting a rail line, which would be great. Not for people, but to move stuff like coal and, you know, starting with material things. If they could connect a rail, that would be something. They've already connected a phone line, so President Moon has a Batman button they can push and talk directly to the leaders. So they reestablish a line. They'll probably do what I was talking about before in Sunshine 1 is reopen the cooperative economic zone, so maybe the moon pies can return. Hopefully more than just chocolate this time. So that'll happen, and that's going to have to happen piece by piece because they can't just all at once eliminate travel restrictions or all these North Korean refugees will flood into the South, which they can't handle. Like, it's good intentions aside, if you let the third world pour into your border, you don't bring them up, they bring you down. Like, you have to have time to assimilate, educate, and, you know, which is fine, but they don't want them all in there. And it's not because of xenophobia or any of that, it's because it doesn't work. That's an economic reality. It's not feasible. That's so hard to explain to Europeans for some reason, though. They, up in Kukistan, which is what I call Sweden, they just, there's no nuance. It's like, well, if you don't allow in third world refugees, even if they come in here and rape people and bully kids, and it doesn't matter. You're a racist.
Right. It's very insane. People have gotten to the point where they believe that any advocating for any restriction in immigration, like literally any restriction, is some, great heresy. It's morally indefensible, and they'll compare you to various early to mid 20th.
Yeah, they'll say Hitler. Yeah, we know.
Yeah.
That's the thing with Europe is because Hitler was over there. I mean, Japan was on the Nazi side, and they colonized China and they annexed Korea. Like, that was worse because they had it for 40 years, but that's what they do is they evoke Hitler and not Stalin. The Allied powers were guilty of torture and blowing up cities and all that too, but they won, so they control the history books. What you should come away with, I just interviewed Tom Goodrich, who wrote Hellstorm. He wrote a new book called Summer 45. Excellent, by the way. World War II shouldn't be seen as this good versus evil canard. It should be like, look, communists killed tens of millions of people, fascists killed millions of people, and democratic republics also killed millions of people. So it's not the type of government that's the problem. Government itself is the problem. Authoritarianism is a problem. But they look at it where everybody knows, like, oh, Hitler's the epitome of evil, we're the good guys, and we went in there and saved everybody, and forget about Dresden, Hamburg, Cologne, Eisenhower's death camps, and all the other terrible things the Allies did, or the fact that these colonial powers murdered 25% of the population on the entire planet prior to World War II, and then genocided the American Indians and Africa, all the rest of it. Forget that, because labor camps, whatever. So they use Hitler to beat people down. Any kind of sense of nationalism at all in Europe is Hitler himself. And that's just sad. And it's sad to me that people will yield their culture, because it's not cultural genocide. It's cultural suicide. They are letting in the third world, because someone might call them names. I just say, you gotta get more of a spine than that. Let them call you names. You can't do that. They tried the same thing in the U.S. because of NAFTA, which I would like to end NAFTA, and I would like to end the social welfare programs. I think if you didn't pour sugar on the floor, you wouldn't get ants, Stop pouring sugar on the floor would be the easiest answer, easier than building a wall. But if they're going to go the other route, people should be allowed to give legitimate criticism of illegal immigration without being accused of racism or xenophobia or any of these horrible things. And you just see it as, look, you're exploiting these people if they come illegally because they're paid under the table. They can get fired whenever. It's corporate exploitation, which you're supposed to be against. And at the same time, you're undermining wages and you're draining the social system of its treasury. It's bad for everyone. But you're not allowed to point any of that out. You can in America. I mean, they will call you racist, but it doesn't work. But in Europe, oh, boy, you bring up the R word, and they're just like, oh, sorry, sir. Let me grab my ankles and spread my cheeks. And I don't know why. And I've had some Europeans trying to explain it to me. Because I'm from the redneck South. So this is about as opposite as you can get from a place like Sweden. They said, imagine a whole country run by soccer moms. And that was actually the scariest thing I've ever thought of. It's like the most horrible thing
I think
ever.
That's quite fitting. Yeah, there's a very maternalistic attitude towards the migrants. I'm loath to call them refugees.
I call it paternalistic racism because it's actually super racist because you're acting like you're judging people according to different standards. You have a lower standard for one group than another, which is fucking racist, you know. But they accuse, you know, it's always they project themselves on everyone else. But they have this maternalistic thing, like, oh, we got to take care of them, but it's always, you know, I'm so willing to spend someone else's money. It ain't theirs.
Yep.
But there is a cure for soccer moms. There is a counter. There's an antidote for soccer moms. And that's redneck dads. That's what Sweden needs. They need to start importing cowboys, and we will clean it up for you.
I've been to Sweden a few times in the last, twice in the last 12 months, actually. And
it's not Sweden.
I hesitate to call it that. There is a thriving nationalist community there.
Okay. Well, then Canada can take that title.
Yeah, I think perhaps that's a bit more fitting.
Because they have Trudeau. So, you know, they get that title just because of him. Until he is, I don't know, maybe Canada is trying to turn the entire country into Trailer Park Boys. Kind of awesome.
Yeah. I was just going to say, though, on the subject of Sweden, that the Sweden Democrats are actually doing quite good, and there is a growing disconnect between the attitudes of elites and the discontent towards Sweden's current trajectory felt by, you know, many of its people. When I went to Sweden, I met plenty of masculine guys who were totally against everything that's going on. So,
all right.
So that's part of the reason why I'm hesitant to call Sweden Kukistan. Also, my boss is Swedish, so there's that factor. But anyways, Ryan, let's go ahead and take a break here. But before we do, why don't we have you tell everyone where they can find your stuff on the internet?
Well, there's ancreport.com that has podcasts, reports, news stories, etc. I have a YouTube channel most of the time because it's been taken down in the past and then sometimes gets reinstated. And it has a goofy name. It's Rise 2 Cents, RYS. The number 2 and sense, like common sense. When I picked that, I didn't know I would ever be on television or semi-famous or anything. I just thought, oh, it's like Thomas Paine and, you know, 2 cents. So there's that. And then I've been blocked on Facebook since Christmas, so forget about that. On Twitter, it's Rye Liberty, R-Y and then Liberty. And those are the main places. ANC Report is the central hub. And there's a Patreon and all that. All the links are on ANC Report. So that's the place to go.
Awesome. And before we go to our break, you've done a number of films. What would be, you know, if someone's interested in checking out your films, but they see that the list is somewhat lengthy, what is a good go-to film, a good first film for people who are just kind of starting to explore your work?
Well, since it's free, I would go either choose War by Deception. It was my first film. It's about 9/11 and the Iraq War because those events tie together. And you can just Google War by Deception and watch that on YouTube. It's lengthy, but if you even watch the first 15 minutes, you'll end up watching the whole thing. Because I'm talking about 9/11, but I don't bring up any of the classic 9/11 kook movement points. It's a very unique path. And then there's a film I made called Decades of Deception. But make sure you're not watching Decade of Deception because some ninny made a film one letter different from mine and her film is terrible. But Decades of Deception goes over 50 years of the CIA's covert operations and horrible things they've been doing all over the world. And that one's sort of like a table of contents of like, oh, you don't believe in conspiracy? Let's talk about Iran-Contra. Let's talk about Operation Gladio, Operation Washtub. Like, it, all these things that have already come to light, all packed in one film. And that one's only 58 minutes. And I like that one. But everybody seems to like War by Deception because 9/11 is such a hot topic, at least for Americans. And which I get it. But those two, let's start on one of those. Plus, they're both free, so.
Yeah. Well, that's always a
the
plus.
Paid films are better, though.
Yeah, no, people should definitely support your work, be it through Patreon or by buying your documentaries. But anyways, let's go ahead and take a break. Hang tight, folks. We'll be right back.